Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We have the ratification debates to go through, and so I just want to give you a background on the importance of these documents. If you understand that the Constitution, and I'm just going to kind of put this in similarities to the Ten Commandments, use that kind of metaphor. The Constitution is like the Ten Commandments. The only way you understand what thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife means, you really have to read the scriptures. The scriptures put context to those commandments, to that ultimate law. You got to understand, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. So how is it that we can start understanding the context of the Constitution? What do we have? Do we have the Supreme Court? No, the Supreme Court doesn't care about the terms and the definitions of what those things really mean. And the interesting thing, and I guess there's a similarity for those who have a religious slant to themselves. If you're one of them, you probably understand that the Ten Commandments and the scriptures that accompany, you know, in the Bible, those all those people that wrote those scriptures had a tie to, like a legal tie in a covenant, because they were, you know, the prophets of God. They were the Son of God and who he chose to be, you know, his mouthpiece in his absence. And so there was a direct, in other words, like a chain of command within the scriptures. And that's the same thing if you look at who are those that are in the covenant of the Constitution, or who are the parties to that contract, because a covenant's like a contract. Well, the parties are the states. So in other words, the states are the stakeholders as well as the mouthpieces for what this thing means. I mean, Madison was really clear in 1821 when he was sending a letter to John G. Jackson that it doesn't matter what he thought. It doesn't matter what the people at the convention of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, it didn't matter what they thought the Constitution meant. What matters is how it was defined and the terms it was defined for understanding to the states at the time of ratification. This is the contractual concept. In other words, if you're told that this contract means all of these things and this is what these lines and words mean in this Constitution, then those are the legally binding definitions and terms of the contract. And I could probably make it a little more simple. If you had a contract that was really creating a lot of power, and basically that contract said, I shall have all these powers, boy, you better be very clear. You know, I shall have all power. Let's just say I should have all power necessary. There's a really good ambiguous thing. That is a general contract. Unless in the contract negotiation part, you actually delineate exactly what those powers are to be. And that's why in that type of a contract, you would probably not ratify it. You'd probably say, well, okay, we'll give you these powers, but we want a Bill of Rights to protect us. Because that's what happened in England. That's what happened in the, I'll just say, Western Society Enlightenment. They realized they just couldn't trust sovereigns anymore. You had to have contractual guarantees that certain rights and privileges of you as a person, as an Englishman, would have these guaranteed rights, the Bill of Rights. And that's the same thing when the American Enlightenment built upon that. The interesting thing is that everybody kept their context or their paradigm on the British Constitution of a general right, or I should say not a general right, a general constitution and general powers. And so that's why they kept on saying, well, we have to have these very specific rights, the Bill of Rights. We have to have these things because that was the paradigm in the British form of government. In the evolutionary, enlightened American form of government, we had an enumerated contract. And apparently they had powers of attorney back then, and we'll get into that when we hit North Carolina. I don't want to get into that now. But I will just say this, that every American, most every American, understands the difference between a general power of attorney and an enumerated power of attorney. And that's precisely the same context to constitutions. You have general constitutions and enumerated constitutions. But what we're going to do today, and the only thing, because I'm not going to go through, you know, the obligatories. The only thing I do want to say is if you want to support this show and you drink coffee, if you're a coffee drinker, I would ask that you support this show by buying Red State Coffee. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and click on the link to Red State Coffee. And please, please buy yourself as much as you possibly can. And by all means, we appreciate your business. And then when you've had yours, give us a call. Our contact, or I should say, our feedback line is 425-270-5416. The only other thing I want to get into before we actually get into the ratification debates is our listen number. If you want to hear this show, we're going to be covering the ratification debates. Okay, so ta-da, this is like scripture, and I can't emphasize this enough. This is the closest thing that we have to defining the terms and the definitions and clarifications of what our Constitution means. When it comes to the greatest governments on the greatest governments ever to be created and instilled, ours is it. And to understand our Constitution, you must read the ratification debates. If not, then how do you understand it? That's why I've talked to many people who were pretty smart on the Constitution, a gentleman that wrote some books on the Constitution. And what I found is that these men were basically trapped in the same paradigms as a lot of other people. This is why reading the ratification debates really is a game changer. It is that much of a game changer because you start to understand who really has the controls, who really is, you know, at the steering wheel regarding the oversight and the protection and so forth over the Constitution, which is the states. So many people refer to it as we the people, and like we're a democracy. No. It's not we the people. It's we the people of the sovereign states. We're supposed to be driving our state, and our state is supposed to be overseeing and protecting us from unconstitutional government. And it's all broken because we've all been convinced we live in a democracy instead of a republican form of government. So I'm not going to get into republicanism. I just recently did that last month. What we're going to do is we're going to dive through the ratification debates. And again, that listen line number is 605-562-4209. Our feedback line is 425-270-5416. And if you want to try Red State Coffee and you want to actually support us, I'll just humbly say that. If you want to support us, go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and you yourself can actually enjoy a very premium coffee and also be supporting us. So thank you so much. And let us move forward. And what we want to do is we want to kind of go through the sequence alphabetically, which means Virginia is going to be the last one we're going to cover, but it's not. Because I always put New York last, not because of the sequence of the ratification, but just that the New York may be the most voluminous ratification debates, but it offers the least amount of real information, and that's because of the best way to say this is because of the discipline that Hamilton had as a lawyer to not say anything that would actually galvanize hardcore definitions. That's why he was so ambiguous. That's why he constantly got into theory and other things. There is so little there that to be honest, the anti-federalist, and when I read through that debate, the anti-federalist, I believe, had the best positions. In other words, I have no idea other than this. The reason New York ratified the Constitution wasn't because they were convinced by the delegates or the Federalists who were in that convention. They ratified the convention, or they ratified the Constitution in that convention, because Virginia did, and they would have been out of the Union had they not, because the Union was moving forward with Virginia. It was the most powerful state, people-wise, commerce-wise, and everything else. And New York was one of its competitors, as well as Massachusetts. Massachusetts was already in. Virginia came in as the big bully, and New York says, hey, we're going to be really left out here if we don't join. And that's really what disappoints me, because if you read Hamilton's positions in the Federalist Papers, he actually takes much more staunch positions regarding the limitations of the Constitution, the limitations of the enumerated powers. He really gets into those same types of Federalist details, but he knows that those are not legally binding. Those are just insightful letters. Anyway, with that, we will be right back. We're going to get into the Delaware debates after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in, and let's get on with the dialogue. Okay, so starting off with Delaware. As you know, Delaware was the rubber stamp state at the time. And just to give you some background, during the Constitutional Convention, it was Delaware and their statement that basically, you know, slapped the rest of the states, all these other bigger states, that says, we don't trust you bigger states. We don't trust you. That if we give you the proportion per you know, per capita, or I should say per population, if we did apportionment only by population, we would become a whipping block and we would lose our sovereignty as a state itself. Now, you have to understand that there were unique differences, and there are still unique differences between the states. Delaware is nowhere equal to Nebraska, and Iowa is nowhere equal to Texas, and Texas is nowhere equal to Rhode Island. If you start looking at the uniquenesses of the different states, whether it be resources, economic and human resources, those types of things, if you look at the climate, if you look like Maine, I mean, Maine is not going to be the breadbasket of the United States. It offers different, its coastline, timber, there are different things, and it has different, very different and unique or disparate interests, which it needed to protect. Because let's say, you know, if you look at the majority of the states don't have a lot of timber. There's only certain states that have a lot of timber that could actually provide building. And so if you had apportionment by population, they could instantly start going down this path of violating the Constitution, saying, we need to make, you know, subsidize, or we need to make lumber dirt cheap so that we can all build better houses. And so we can all have equal type of houses instead of it being more expensive in this state. And if you ever wondered why in certain states more houses were built with brick than with timber, because it was all driven by the demand and availability of the markets, right? Supply and demand. So bricks were obviously more in supply in certain states than timber was. And they still used timber, but they used limited amounts. But anyway, this kind of shows how different these states were. But the whole point here is that Delaware was the state that actually said, hey, look, we don't trust you. You're going to take advantage of us. And that one thing created a new paradigm in republicanism. And I've gone through this before, how Richard Sherman, not the football player, Richard Sherman, or hold it, it is Roger Sherman. Richard Sherman is the football, whichever isn't the football player, because I get confused with names. Anyway, the Sherman Compromise understood sovereignty was tiered in government. This was a new concept, because understanding in a Republican form of government, a true Republican form of government, that means that you have representation. Well, if all the people, you know, had the say, if we were the sovereigns, if we were the ultimate sovereigns of all things, then we would have a democracy. So either you have a democracy or you have a Republican form of government. So, folks, this is where you have to come to this plateau, this paradigm shift. You need to get there to understand that we are not supposed to have the say over certain things. It really bothers conservatives with the fact that they don't have the vote to vote for president. We're not supposed to. We're not supposed to have direct elections. We have representatives. That's why we have electors and we have representatives. Those are the only two people we vote for in the federal government, per the concept and design of the Constitution, that our electors would represent us and they would vote and their vote would be counted for the president. The state would have no control or no say over that elector except for two. The state, which would be the state legislatures, would control the two electors that they would have for the Senate, and then the people would elect their own elector. And so we've completely lost that in the Electoral College, in the election of the president. It's still within the Constitution. It's still the constitutional requirement, but we don't follow that. We follow this perverted and subversive concept of popular votes and party systems, party primaries, and so forth. But if you understand republicanism, this was a huge paradigm shift, because instantly counties became sub-elements of government, because we have sovereigns at our county level, and they are supposed to be representing theirs and our interest in protecting us in the Senate. Each county is supposed to have one vote, one representative, not broken down as it is perverted today, where in the states you have it all apportioned by people, that they're representing the people, no longer the counties. So no wonder some of these, you know, agricultural counties and the timber counties and so forth are being, you know, decimated, because at the needs of the population centers, they're destroying this. I'm just going to say this. I'm going to say this very clearly. If you understand republicanism, and if you understand what should be happening, then if Trump wins the White House and the Republicans take back Congress, and you live in a state that has a population center that is dragging you down, like you live in Illinois, and Chicago is literally dragging, they're decimating your other counties, Washington State, Seattle, Portland, Oregon, even Salt Lake City, Utah. If you start looking at some of these states, come up with a plan where your county supervisors, your county commissioners, whatever you call your county sovereigns, have them be ready in 2021, January 2021, to call for state constitutional conventions to rewrite the Constitution. What will happen? I guarantee this will happen. The population centers will say, well, we want more proportion. We want a greater proportion because we have more people in our county than you. And then you have to stand up and say, sorry, this is a representative government of the counties, not a representative government of the people. And when it comes to our constitution, we have lost our representation. And they say, well, sorry, we're not going to let you do that. Then you go to the Republican Congress, which should be fully controlled by Republicans, and make them finally define the Republican form of government so that the counties can be saved and the counties become sovereign again. It will force the issue. And this is the beauty, my friends. I want you to understand this concept. And I've gone down this path of Republicanism where I really wanted to get into Delaware, but I want you to understand this is because this is the strategy today, that we need to have these conventions in every state that has big, huge population centers, even Tennessee, even Kentucky, Iowa, Indiana, Nevada, every single one of you red states that actually has turned blue because of the population centers and because of all these dolts that are trying to push you into socialism. This is where you go and you say, we want full representation. This will force Congress to finally make the decision and say, no, you need to give the counties full representation. And what will end up happening is you'll either get your constitution back or you will be able to split your state. And then you've neutralized the blue senators that are representing your state. Do you understand what I just said? Now that Nevada has now been gained 2 seats in the Senate, it will no longer be two only blues. It'll be 2 blues and 2 reds. And so what we'll actually do is we'll completely marginalize, take half of the representation of the blue states, and the remaining red states that don't need splitting, like the Dakotas, Wyoming, and Oklahoma, where there's not real, maybe Oklahoma might because of Oklahoma City. But if you start understanding my whole point here, that all of the solid red states will actually take back the Senate in an overwhelming way. It will take a long time to shift that. Soros has never accounted for this because these idiots don't understand the Constitution. We have everything we need within the Constitution and the constitutional framework that the framers have given us. We've got everything we need. They've just duped us into surrendering our sovereignties by thinking of things in a democratic form and going down these different paths that they've wanted to lead us to. Now, getting into Delaware. So Delaware created this huge paradigm shift regarding republicanism. And so here's the interesting thing. They start off with this one comment. We, the deputies of the people of the Delaware State in convention, met having taken into our serious considerations the federal constitution proposed and agreed upon the deputies of the state in a general convention had at the city of Philadelphia on the 17th day of September in the year of our Lord. Wow, they're throwing the Lord in there. See, who says that these weren't Christian people? Held at the, at the year of our Lord, 1787, have approved, assented to, ratified, and confirmed. The sad thing is that the Delaware delegates did not discuss. They basically looked at it. They all agreed because it was very clear to them that they had a big protection because of this new concept of American republicanism. So Delaware became the rubber stamp state, and there were 30 delegates to represent all of the people of Delaware at the time. You can't tell me that that was done by we the people. It was we the 30 people of Delaware. And I'll get into more of the we the people stuff when we come back. When we come back, we'll also be heading into Georgia. So we'll be right back after this. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open. Well, so let's get moving forward. We want to close out this, the Delaware ratification. Forgive me. I want you to understand that this was done so quickly that, the ink was still kind of wet on the parchment because Delaware ratified the Constitution December 7th, okay? So what had to happen was on the 17th, the Constitution was sent. It wasn't there the next day. It had to be carried via horseback to each of the state legislatures. Then the state legislatures had to convene. They may not have been in session in September at that point in time. So they had to convene so that they could address this and then make a decision to have an election to appoint the delegates and then have the delegates meet in an appointed place by the state legislatures to go and debate the Constitution to ratify it. Well, Delaware did this in what, less than 3 months' time. That's amazing. If you understand how slow things operated back then, they actually got this stuff done. I mean, in some ways, they were so efficient politically, and in some ways, they weren't because of technology and so forth. I look at today and understanding what they did, to me, this was phenomenal. Now, the next ratification debate that we're going to cover was actually the ratification by Georgia, which was another quick one. Now, it wasn't necessarily a quick rubber stamping, but they actually had the Constitution ratified on the 2nd of January, 1788. Just so you understand, Georgia was definitely a disparate type of colony from Delaware. Delaware was a colony of affluence. Compared to Georgia, you got to remember, Georgia was a colony that was a penal colony, kind of. The people that were there that established and settled Georgia, the original design and the original populating of Georgia was twofold. It was strategic, first of all, because they needed to have a dense populated state between the Carolinas and Florida. Why? Well, who cares about Florida? Well, the crown of England cared because they understood that the Spaniards had a good stronghold down in Florida. So what they wanted to do was they wanted to create a colony that they could densely populate. So instead of having commercial endeavors and so forth, what they did was they went through their penal system and they found the least repugnant criminals in their system who may have been white-collar crimes or what have you. And they said, hey, we're going to offer you an opportunity to go, you know, to be free, kind of. But what you're going to have to do is we'll send you out to America, to this new place called the Colony of Georgia. And you'll be an indentured servant for 7 years. And once, you know, you've worked off your debt, we will give you 10 acres of land. And then you can have, you know, whatever, you know, freedom and do whatever you want to do as long, because you got to remember, Britain was a mercantile economic system. So you can only grow certain things like tobacco or what have you. They told you what you had to grow. And I believe in the South, they grew rice as well. But anyway, nevertheless, Georgia was really broken into much smaller plantations considering the northern states of that, because indentured servants that worked off their debt for the big investors were granted 100 square acre lands or 100 acres of land. And supposedly these were supposed to be good agricultural growth land, but a lot of times somebody didn't get that. All they wanted to do was do the agriculture on good flat land or what have you. If you're going to do growing crops, you want your land to be very well, good productive type of land. You don't want a hillside or a slope, which is, I'm going to just point to China. China doesn't have a lot of really good productive land. That's why they had to do rice paddies in tiers along the hillsides and so forth. It forced them to become very collective in sharing resources and so forth in China. That's why, and I've said this before, China had a propensity as a society to be communal in living, and basically they adapted very well to communism. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, culturally, they were more apt to being great communists than even Russia or any other nation because of this communal paradigm that they had lived for thousands of years under different dynasties and so forth collectively. And so that's how, China's paradigm. But anyway, Georgia was kind of in this boat of being a strategic colony. But the reason why Georgia was quick, very quick to ratify this, unlike North Carolina was kind of, I don't want to say on the boat or, on the fence, but Carolina actually did not ratify the Constitution. I think it was South Carolina? No, it was North Carolina. North Carolina did not ratify the Constitution until after the first year of governance. They actually came into the Union where they had no say over the Bill of Rights because the Bill of Rights was already being voted upon in Congress. It was already done. The ink was dry. And so I don't even think they had an election to actually have people in the houses at that point in time. They may have, but my point is that Georgia was so quick because they understood some of the advantages, the political advantages that they gained by allowing slavery and the institution of slavery to perpetuate itself up into 1808, and that it was a state issue, that the federal government was limited. So it's the same thing with religion and all these other things. The federal government, because we did not create a centralized government. I really don't care where you stand on slavery. You have to understand this, that we created a limited general government and that the states were sovereigns and the states had to work out their own issues. The real problem came in when they violated the Constitution regarding slavery was the Missouri Compromise. Slavery was so repugnant that they had to force states to become slave states because they realized that some of the new states that were coming in, well, they weren't going to be slave states. And they said, hold it. We're going to lose our representation. We're going to lose our, you know, our 50% hold in Congress. And how do you think you would feel if you were, you know, if you saw slavery as a bad thing? How would you feel if you were forced to be a slave state? You, the people, you had to have slavery. Well, not too many people would probably have plantations, so there wouldn't be a lot of slave owners, but you're still supposed to have this paradigm. You can't force these things onto people. And this is one of the reasons why Missouri was in the position it was in the mid-1800s with the Dred Scott case. See, I'm really bad with names. Forgive me. The Dred Scott case was Dred Scott was actually released and freed by a jury of his peers, or actually they weren't even his peers. There was no slaves in the jury. These were all white men. And they all released him to be a free man. It was the Supreme Court of the Southern court system, because if, and I talk about this in We the People, whose constitution is it anyway, if you look at where the judges were being selected from, they were deliberately being selected from those who had a favorable view of slavery. And in other words, when Taney, who was the Supreme Court justice, basically said, I don't care if you think you're a free man, that state doesn't have the power. This was a state issue. They had no jurisdiction over this. And Taney overstepped his bounds and forced Dred Scott into being a slave again. He ultimately got released, I believe, but that's not the point. Here was a slave state. Missouri was a slave state, and because it was the Missouri Compromise, and they refused to accept slavery. And so the federal government stepped in and says, no, you can't do this. And they had no jurisdiction. Remember, slavery was a state issue. And when the federal government started actually perpetuating slavery and racism after that, you could tell that they were trying, the Supreme Court and its agenda was to drive divisive politics throughout America to decimate us, or actually to make us enemies of each other. Come on, people, wake up. This whole division crap is what's destroying us. But anyway, back to the ratification by the state of Georgia. If you kind of look, and I just wanted to give you the back brief on this, because there's hardly anything. This is basically one page. The Delaware one was barely a page. The Georgia is about a page and a half, and that's because they have all the signatories. And, oh, by the way, there were only, even though Georgia was more populated than Delaware, they only had 25 delegates. So, in convention Wednesday, January the 2nd, 1788, to all whom these present shall come, greeting. Whereas the form of a constitution for the government of the United States of America was on the 17th day of September, 1000, blah, 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 blah. And they basically say, whereas we did ratify this on the 2nd of June. Fact of the matter is, they did not get into a vigorous debate. I don't know if, and I've, you know, if you want to support us, if you want to support this cause, the best thing you could do is buy us the volumes, or help us get the volumes from the the documented history of the ratifications of the Constitution, which is out of the University of Wisconsin's Rotunda. If we got those documents, I could actually give you all of the accurate details, but nobody wants you to have these things. But anyway, we will be right back after this, and I'll expound on that. Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, let me expound a little bit on why nobody wants the ratification debates to be a part of the discussion. Because they understand that the ratification debates expose how far the federal government has slid and how they've abused their positions and with lies and deceit and have usurped so many state powers. And they, the whole design was by the statist, if you want to call them the statist, those who were a part of big government in the Federalist. The Federalist, in the very beginning, when Madison was a part of the Federalist, it was about a limited and defined government. That was the whole paradigm of the Federalist. All of a sudden, the Federalist had these Tories, these people with Tories sentiments like Alexander Hamilton, that wanted a king, that wanted a grand government, a centralized government, and an all-powerful government through a general constitution, did everything they could to try to obscure the facts in building this house of cards. So, as they started moving forward, Hamilton started injecting these concepts of implied powers. He started actually using unconstitutional things such as precedents, case law, and those types of things to where the court could start bending and changing the Constitution without any say by the states. Many people really started believing that the Constitution was the ultimate arbiter over the Constitution when they were not. They were not the ultimate arbiters. The states are, and they still are. They are the stakeholders of the Constitution. So, what I want to do is I want you to understand why the ratification debates are so important. Because they actually lay waste to every argument that the statists have been using for the past two centuries. How did they know this, though? How did they know to obscure these things? Because a guy by the name of John Marshall, who actually spoke truthfully during the convention to get the Constitution ratified, then started changing his paradigm, tone, and everything else in his rulings in self-aggrandizing. Because people did not have the maturity of contract law at the time, they didn't hold on to this treasure, this national treasure called the ratification debates, as legally binding definitions. Because they could have easily slapped these Federalists, or I should say these statists, around as they started usurping power to say, clearly it was defined this way, not the way you're describing it, Chief Justice. And as a matter of fact, you are committing perjury because you were actually conflicting with the words that you said to sell the contract. And now you're trying to take advantage in perverting and bending the contract. And John Marshall, by the rights of the moral perjury concept, he should have been removed from office and he should have been tried as treason because he was violating the Constitution as defined. And so we were all duped. We were all deceived. As a matter of fact, a good friend of mine, Douglas V. Gibbs, has written a book about the most mischievous people that have done more damage to the Constitution than anyone else. And so it's a pretty good book. I think it has the seven or top nine people. And John Marshall is one of the very key top people that has violated the Constitution. Anyway, so now we move to Massachusetts. And Massachusetts actually convened their convention. So just so you understand, Massachusetts is a little closer to Philadelphia than Georgia, right? And they actually tried to convene this convention as quickly as possible, and they were holding their convention through the middle of January. Now, what does that mean, Massachusetts holding the ratification debates convention in the middle of January? Well, if you've ever been to Massachusetts, that's smack dab in the middle of the worst weather of the year. And they talked about freezing and so forth. And actually, there's one of the delegates at the Constitutional Convention that was not invited because he refused to sign the Constitution. And I forget, Eldridge Gerry. Eldridge Gerry was denied becoming a delegate because he refused to sign the Constitution. And it wasn't because Massachusetts was enamored by the Constitution. They recognize, and this is the only ratification debates that recognizes the divine hand of providence involved in this process, or they speak very clearly about it. We're going to get into that. This is the one ratification debate that actually has a very Christian undertone, if you understand what I'm saying. And so as we dive into this, I just want you to understand that Eldridge Gerry was asked to come after they realized that he held some important information regarding the ratification debates. Eldridge Gerry was asked to attend, and he attended, but he was either late or a no-show. I mean, he didn't help his cause in why he didn't sign the Constitution, because he wanted a Bill of Rights. And I think Eldridge Gerry, if you understand who he was, I mean, have you ever heard of gerrymandering? It's actually Gerry. It should be pronounced gerrymandering. And Eldridge Gerry was, he was a guy that was apparently, I just see this guy. He may have been a good guy, but I think he had these machinations. There's the word. He had machinations that were not necessarily to the true intent or to the true concept that the Constitution was created for. In other words, just like Hamilton. Hamilton signed off on the Constitution, accepting this is what we get, and then he started instantly working and trying to create advantages and so forth. And Eldridge Gerry did the same thing, because gerrymandering is how you can start to split districts to create an outcome, a political outcome, of the way you want. So that you don't have strong bastions where you actually have conservatives, you actually have liberals controlling every single district. And so, you know, deciding how to divide, I understand there's a little bit of politics involved in that. That's not a straight cut plan. But I will tell you that if you use a map with north being the top, south being the bottom, east and west, you know, to the right and left, then the whole concept of how to lay out a area, you know, by using the geographic terms is the best way. Because bottom line, you can't be accused of gerrymandering and trying to manipulate a political outcome. That's the way, as a matter of fact, I believe Thomas Jefferson's father was trying to create squares of land instead of, you know, these odd shapes of land when he was doing his land was surveying. He was Thomas Jefferson's father was a surveyor, and Thomas Jefferson learned some of that. That's where Thomas Jefferson learned a lot of his science, was from his father as well as from his homeschooling. So anyway, I've digressed. What we want to do is I want to get into the very first note. And the first note, or the first part of, and oh, by the way, this is 133 pages. As I have taken the debates of Massachusetts and put it into a Word document, this is a total of 133 pages. I'm not reading 133 pages, but I want you to know that we're going to be starting off, and we're going to be going through some things. And as a matter of fact, I realize I've only got 2 minutes, and I'm only going to kick this one off. This one note actually comes from, let me see here. Let me find out where this guy is. This guy is Mr. King. And he is probably a reverend, because most of these guys up there were of the clergy. And this is what he says. "We now come, sir, to the consideration of the powers with which the government shall be clothed. The introduction to this Constitution is in the words, 'We the people,' etc. The language of the Confederation is 'We the states,' etc. The latter is merely federal government of states. Those, therefore, that assemble under it have no power to make laws to apply the individuals of the states confederated. And the attempts to make laws for collective societies necessarily leave a discretion to comply with them or not. In no instance has there been so frequent deviation from first principles as in the neglect or refusal to comply to the requisitions of general governments for the collections of money." Now, I want to make a point out of this. He calls this the "we the states," but Mr. King, and I don't believe this was Rufus King, this gentleman did not really understand, because the Constitution prior to its signing actually read, "We the people of the states of," and then it says the states of Georgia, the states of, and literally went through the alphabetical order of all 13 states, which, in other words, the preamble, the very front end of the Constitution, was very long, because it identified the "we the people of the 13 sovereigns. And so it's really important that I say this, because people that see that "we the people," they think that it's the people only that are the sovereigns, not recognizing the states. But when you go through the document, only the states ratify amendments. Only the states were ratifying the Constitution. Of course, it was proposed to the people, but in a Republican form of government, it was proposed to the representatives of the people, not the people themselves. I hope this really helps clarify, you know, the what the "we the people" all means, and what the whole context of the beginning of the Constitution means. It's not a democracy. We are a Republican form of government. We're going to really take off in the Massachusetts debates as of our next episode. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.